My name is Hamish Sewell, and I'm talking to Austin Whitaker. Today's date is the 9th of November, and we're in Bundaberg as part of the Story Project. And Austin, I'd like to ask you when you were born.
I was born on the 2nd of January 1926.
Could you describe what Bundaberg was like in your early days?
Yeah, well, I told you before, my two brothers were born in the same hospital 4 years apart, and we moved to another house down behind this garage I was telling you about. So for the first 4 or 5 years I don't remember too much about it, but as I suppose from 3 or 4 we started to play in this garage I was telling you about.
And this was your dad's garage?
Yeah, the big coach and motor body building works.
Where was that?
Corner of Wallace Street and Bourbon Street. It's not there now, but it was a pretty big business in those days. He employed about 15 men, which is a big business in those days. And it wasn't just coach and motor body building. There was the garage that did mechanical work. There were carpenters who built all these trucks from a chassis. There was a paint shop where they painted them. We used to get into trouble because there was gold leaves in there. The paint, they used to do that lovely English printing on the side of the baker and so on, three-dimension, and then it'd be set up with this gold sheeting. And we'd get in there with coins or something and fiddle around, and our father would hit the roof and say, that's the most expensive bit of paper in Bundaberg.
So it was gilding.
Gold gilding. Yeah, just about came in sheets like that.
Yeah.
If you did it, you know, you could get an impression on there.
Yeah, yeah.
Put a coin under it and rub at the top of it and get a gold coin underneath.
So you used to play around the coach and motor body works.
Yeah, a lot. And I told you, my mother told us to keep away from the blacksmith, who was my grandfather, because he was pretty, if he hit his hand or anything, he used to swear. You could hear him a mile away swearing. And I think the men who worked there were scared of him. I don't think he ever cut his hair. It was like a gollywog. And he looked, to me, he looked like he was 100 years of age, but he was a pretty tough sort of a bloke, you know, swinging hammers and on the Fords. They used to make all the parts for these trucks that they built. All the brackets and so on, we'd buy them today from a hardware store. They're all made on the forge and anvil. Everything was like metal that heated up in the forge and was hot, and they'd shape it on the anvil. You know how the anvils have the different, there's a pointed end there that you can make round things and square things and all sorts of things.
And you described to me before how they used to make the wooden
the steel wheels.
Do you want to describe that?
Yeah, well, they eventually got on to building these vehicles, but before that, Bundaberg still had a lot of horse and drays. The farmers, you know, still had their carts. Some of them only one horse, some two horses, some four horses, and even some of the delivery blacks around Bundaberg had big flat-top drays with horses. So there was they used to make these, first of all, the men would make this huge wheel with a big hub in the middle, all the wooden spokes going out from it, and they'd take it out in the backyard and it'd be lying down on the ground, and the blacksmith would have got this bit of flat metal about that thick, and they had big rollers, you know, they'd keep rolling and tightening it up until it became a circle.
Yep.
And they'd take that out the yard, and then they used to put bricks or rocks down in the yard to raise this steel heap up like that, and all the scraps out of the shop, all the bits of timber, they'd stack those up around these rocks, and they'd probably put a bit of petrol on it just to start a good fire, and the fire would be burning for half an hour or so, and this steel heap would eventually get red hot or white hot. And so then about 6 men had come along with these huge tongs that they have in blacksmith shops, and they'd stand around the heap and pick it up and take it over, put it on this wooden spoked wheel, and then someone would hose it. And as soon as they hosed it, it went and all the steam came up, and because they wet it, it shrunk, contracted, so it was there forever on the wheel.
So it must have been quite exciting to be a kid when you were watching all this stuff. When your granddad's there and he's swearing and hitting his finger every now and then, and he's a wild man, and you've got these spokes being forged.
Yeah, what used to happen, our mum used to, when this was all finished, there were still asses' coals there, Mum used to go up, bring down about a dozen potatoes, put them in, and they were lovely, like put them in the fire. They'd be black on the outside, but you'd have to peel it off, and then put butter on and just eat the potato with butter on it. Beautiful.
And do you remember any of the characters there?
Oh, yeah, I remember some of them. I remember the carpenter. He was a terrific bloke. One of the things he was building, they bought this huge chassis, and it was about as long, almost as long as this room. And it turned out it was for the sanitary wagon. In those days, there was no sewage. They still had these night carts. And this fellow, he had some assistants. They built up this big building on the back of the chassis. And it just had a shelf in the centre, about that much space down the bottom, that much space up the top. And that's where the men who went around collecting the night sewer, they had to put these tins in there. And we used to play inside of that. My mother used to say, you won't be playing in there in a few months' time.
So that was where they were collecting all the leftovers from the toilets?
Yeah, well, there was no sewage in those days.
Yeah. Where were they putting that, I wonder?
Oh, it used to be taken out to a dump somewhere and burnt.
Because I know around Sydney they used to use that for the Chinese market gardens.
Yeah, well, I can tell you all about that. There was a lot of Chinese lived down there, and one of them, my mother used to buy vegetables. He had beautiful vegetables, and he had a big 44-gallon drum in the middle of the garden and a tap down the bottom. And that's how he used to make his fertiliser. They still do it in China now.
So you put the sewage in the top,
yeah,
and then just take
the top here and just let it, I don't know, put some water in and leave it for so long.
Yeah.
And then he just turned the tap on and it was liquid fertiliser.
So do you remember any of the Chinese from back then?
Yeah, I do. Do you want me to talk about them?
Yeah, please.
I still haven't finished about the garage. There's a lot more there.
Let's go back to the garages. Yeah. Let's finish that, sorry.
In those days, you wouldn't remember, but you wanted petrol. The petrol bowsers are always out on the footpath. Do you remember that?
A little bit.
Yeah. And my father's, because it was on a corner of Bourbon Street and Waller Street, that was the first garage in Bundaberg. He knocked the corner of the garage right out and made a driveway. You could drive in from Waller Street or Bourbon Street, and the bowsers were put inside instead of out on the footpath. Like if it was raining like hell, the attendant who went out to serve the petrol, he got wet. I mean, you got out of your car, you got wet, but because this was the driveway, it came in at about a 45, no, not 45, but like a semicircle. And what else? Oh, he had the first hydraulic lift in Bundaberg. Like behind our shop was one of those, all the garages used to have a wooden ramp. They had the two tracks like that, and you drove your car up, and the men got underneath to do all the work. That's what every garage had, but he was the first one to have this hydraulic lift where, you know, the big steel centre, and you press them, or you turn the power on and put the car on it and goes up, and then they had grease guns, you know, greasing all the nipples and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he imported American cars, things like Hudson Terraplane, Chrysler Plymouths, Dodges, Chevrolets, Buicks, Cadillacs. And before he started to import them, every car in Bundaberg was the old-fashioned car with running boards and the canvas hood. You remember those?
No.
And he had the first car in Bundaberg, solid. It was a Chrysler Plymouth, solid metal, the whole thing. It just looked like the early Holden that came out, just one shape. And I still remember the number is 246759.
Mm.
It was a real olive green colour.
Mm.
I've got photos of that at home too.
So you must have felt like $1 million driving around in that.
We did, yeah. And another thing, my mother taught us to drive when we were only 11 or 12, and this is in the other cars. Oh, it might have been this one too. She used to drive out in the bush somewhere. And first of all, like she'd be driving, and we were sitting in, she'd let us take the steering wheel and steer, but then eventually she'd stop the car and she had a couple of cushions, and it was the gear, no automatic gears, so it was this big gear lever out of the floor, and she taught us actually how to change gears and how to drive, and then like when we got near a town she'd change over, but I'd go to school the next day and tell the kids I can drive a car. And they say, oh, yeah, you know, pull this one. I used to say they probably thought, you know, I was just steering it. But myself and my older brother actually drove when we were about 10, 11 or 12, which is pretty good, I thought.
And that was in the late 30s.
Yeah.
So we're still talking the Depression here.
Yeah, well, I was born 26, so it would have been middle, it would have been 34, 35, 36.
So right in the middle of the Depression.
Yeah, the Depression was earlier. They talked, I don't remember that, but they talked about it in the 1931, 32. That's when a lot of the men had to travel away from Bundaberg, you know, the swaggies. And they called, have you heard about jumping the rattler?
The train?
Yeah, they used to have to, like if they wanted to go from Bundaberg out of Gladstone, they couldn't afford to go on a bus or no planes, but the trains would be going along pretty slow and they'd jump on them. That called jumping the rattler because of the rattling noise on the track.
Mm.
And they'd finish up on a farm somewhere and, you know, ask the farmer could they stay the night, and he'd give them some jobs, put a new fence in or do something and give them a meal and maybe a bit of food to get, you know, take on the next place.
I guess that was the end of a whole generation of itinerants, wasn't it?
That's what a lot of men had to do, and try and save a bit of money to send home to their families. But when you see movies about it now, the swaggies and carrying their humpy and walking on the road, you know, sleeping rough under the trees and under bridges. And
do you actually remember that?
No, not really. That was due to the Depression days. I would have been 6 or 7.
But your dad was a man of means.
Yeah, well, it was a pretty big business. And I also, besides importing these American cars, he imported Johnson outboard motors, like little ones and really big ones. And he built his own speedboat. And my mother, she reckons he couldn't swim, so she built a kapok, you know, this life jacket. She made it herself out of kapok so that if he had a crash, he'd at least float. But there's still a cup at home that he won some race in the Queensland Championships or something. It's still in grey, but you can hardly see it.
Did you go out on the boat with him?
No, I never did. And because these outboard motors were Johnson's, that was the American brand, he called his boat Baby Johnson.
Right.
And these engines used to come in huge pine crates. So the men used to have to take them all out. And they were pretty fixed inside so that, you know, rigid, you could turn them upside down. You could turn the crate upside down and the engine would still be there.
So they were packed crates?
In pine crates.
Pine crates.
So that was a lot of the timber that they'd use when they were making these the steel hoop, plus all the scraps that came out of the workshop.
So where did your dad get his head start from?
I don't know. I don't know if he won the casket. There wasn't caskets in those days.
So what are your sort of memories of Bundaberg before you left school and went for the war? What are your memories of this town? What was it like?
Well, where we lived down around that garage, do you want me to tell you about the Chinese people?
Yeah, please. But just first of all, give me a snapshot of what Bundaberg was like.
Well, I can remember a lot of the streets weren't bitumen, they were dirt. And there was no such thing as curbing and guttering. It was just footpaths just came down and you know, no curbing and guttering. In fact, this is a touchy subject, but this carpenter in the shop, the fellow built all the trucks, he built us a nice sledge, beautiful thing, you know, the skis on the bottom. We used to put soap on it to make it go faster, and it had a rope tied on the back, on the front, and the kids, we used to race along the footpath, and I was riding it this time, and the kids pulled me over this gutter where there's no curbing, and I went up in the air and sat down on a broken bottle. And this is where, you know, you got a lot of flesh. And I raced home, and neighbours reckon they thought I was being shot. I raced home screaming with blood running down my leg. And my mother in those days was no such thing as Band-Aid. She reckoned she just tore up old sheets. And I was about 4 or 5 or 6, and she reckons I was still wearing nappies. Because, you know, instead of putting a Band-Aid on or a dressing, you can get there. I had this damn thing all over me. And I've still got the scar there to prove it.
Oof.
Not going to show you.
No. So it must have got pretty muddy when it rained.
Oh, it did, yeah. And the lawns, there was no such thing as electric mowers. We had that old coil cast lawn mower, which were pretty hard to push. Or even the scythe, if the grass got too long. You remember the old-fashioned scythes?
Mm.
It was a shaped handle with this big blade, curved blade. And it was a real art. You had to make sure the blade, you know, couldn't have it up like that. It had to be level. And like the men out in the farms, that's how they cut a lot of the wheat and so on. Mm. And it was a bit of an act to do it, to cut the... It used to cut it down pretty low. It depends how sharp the scythe was.
And did the cane used to come into town?
Yeah. In the early days, they used to have what they called juice mills all around Bundaberg. Like there was the main mill at Milliken, but all around Bundaberg they had what they called juice mills. And what they did, the cane was delivered to those mills by the farmers, mostly on horse and dray, you know, wagons. And the cane was put through at these juice mills. They had big rollers, and they used to roll the juice out of the cane, and the juice used to come into milk and not the cane itself. I suppose, I don't know how they did, they must have had big wooden vats or something, but they would have come in by horse and cart to Milliken. But there was about, I don't know, 15 or so scattered around Bundaberg juice mills.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of them, I told you my mother was orphaned. She was born in Charters Towers and she was orphaned at 10, and she was sent to live, her and her two brothers, with relatives. And this Uncle Bill that she was sent to live with, he was the cook at one of these juice mills at Pemberton, that's on the way to Elliot Heads. And she used to tell us about, he used to make this big bowl of porridge for the workers there, and there was always some left over. And there was a horse called Dobbin. He used to come up the back of the kitchen. It was one of those kitchen doors, you know, half a wooden door. And this Dobbin used to come up every morning for his porridge, whatever porridge was left over. He used to eat it. I hope it was washed out before the next day.
Mm, mm.
And she went to the Pemberton school there. The school's still there, but it's not a school now, it's a kindergarten.
Yeah.
And then she came in to live with an auntie in town and went to the central school.
Yeah.
And the fact that she was born in Charter says in 1899, she used to like boasting, like last century, she used to like boasting that she was born in the previous century.
Yeah.
But now, you know, there's another century of gone still.
Yeah, you can do the same. We can both do the same.
Yeah. Anyway, you want me to get on these Chinese people?
Yes, please do. Yeah. How much time we got?
You've got another 20 minutes,
22
minutes.
Oh, yep. Plenty of time. Yeah, well, obviously this garage, we're on the corner of Waller and Bourbon Street. Diagonally across on that side, there was QE's, Q-E-E-H-E-E. There's a street named in Bundaberg after them. Runs off Walker Street down to Ball and Swamp. And they had a big fruit and vegetable shop, but they also sold fireworks it was a Guy Fox night, and we called it Cracker Night. I mean, today shops can't sell fireworks, they're banned. Everyone at Bundaberg used to come down. They would have imported them from Hong Kong or China. And we'd buy skyrockets. They weren't very big, but you'd set them off in a bottle. And sometimes you'd knock the bottle, you'd light the skyrocket, and the bottle would fall over, and you had to run for your life. You didn't know which way it was going to go.
And the Chinese were the ones who were selling those?
Yeah, well, this QE's every year, like probably for a fortnight, half of Bundaberg used to go down there buying their supplies for Cracker Night. And on Cracker Night, you could hear the whole of Bundaberg, you know, just about blowing up. And the one thing they used to do, just to show thanks for all the stuff that they sold, there was a vacant paddock opposite where their shop was, and they used to put on a special fireworks show. They had a tripod built in the middle, it piles about that thick, you know, tied up the top like if you're building an Indian teepee. And the last thing they did was hang this, they would have been imported from China, this huge thing full of, it was all fireworks, big packets, little packets, right down, it almost touched the ground. Then they'd light it up down there, and everything would go bang, 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 and things shooting out, and it went on for about, you know, 10 minutes or so before it got to the top. That was the final act, but before that they'd let off big skyrockets, and they'd put those things on the fences, on nails that spin around, you know, those things that...
Dragon wheels.
Spin around, they shoot all the stars out. And then there was ink wells, things like ink wells that shoot up stars, and all the different sorts of bungers. And we had to be careful. Some kids, we'd buy a bunger that was pretty big, and the wicks weren't very long. And you'd use a match a lot, and sometimes you'd go like this to throw it, and thing would go off. I mean, some kids lost fingers, you know. Like even a little Tom Thumb could make a fair bit of noise.
So there was QE's. What about other Chinese businesses?
Yeah, on opposite QE's on the other corner was Billy Lee King, LEEKING, Billy Lee King. He also sold fruit and vegetables. And what we used to do, like we were only a block away from the river in Waller Street, and on a weekend we lived down the river fishing and falling in and shrimping. You know what shrimps, you know, prawns. My mother used to make the rim of a bike, you know, the rim of a bike. You'd always get an old rim, and she'd put mosquito netting underneath to make, you know, make the scoop. And you tied, the rim's got holes in it, so you'd tie about four strings up. Then you'd have the long string, so we'd be down the river. A lot of the places had little jetties. We wouldn't go out in the deep water. You'd go near the bank where the mud was in it. It'd eventually come down like that. So we'd put the... Oh, and you had to have a piece of rotten fish, or you'd go to the butcher and get a stinking old bone or something, and you'd let the dilly down, and you'd wait about 10 minutes and pull it up slowly. And there's always, you know, half a dozen shrimps. Sometimes you get a prawn, or you get a little bony brim fish, we'd throw those back. But for this Chinese bloke, in those days there was a Milliken sugar mill had what they made syrup. There was a Milliken syrup tin about this big, 5 pound syrup tin. We used to fill that up with shrimp, take us all afternoon, and we'd go and see Billy D. King when we came home. And he'd give us a shilling. And there was four of us, so we got threepence each. Mm. And they'd cook them, you know, would have made a pretty good feed.
Mm.
The other thing, we used to play over in this place at night time, he used to buy bananas by the bunch when they were green, and he had these big, long shelves at the side of his shop, or at the back they were, big boxes, and he used to put bags over them to put the bananas in, and light joss sticks and put the bags over the head, and there was the joss sticks made heat, so that's the way they were wrapping the bananas. And we used to play there and jumping at night time into these boxes and so on. And the Chinese, Billy Lee King and about six other Chinese were over there playing mahjong or even smoking opium, because I don't remember it, but it was an opium den further up. In the earlier days, a lot of Chinese came to Mount Perry. You heard of Mount Perry with the gold? They did a lot of gold mining up there. And the Chinese came out here to make their fortune. And a lot of them finished up in Bundaberg or went back to China. But
and the opium was a bit of an issue, wasn't it? Because I believe
it was the early days. I don't remember it as a kid, but people talked about it and I've read about it.
Mm.
And they were... I've seen them on TV, just little cubby holes, and they'd lie in there and smoke the opium.
Mm. Mm.
And now the third Chinese bloke was Billy Quinton. That might have been Quinton. He was on the same side as our workshop, but a bit further up. Now he's the one, he was fruit and vegetables, but he was the one who had this big garden patch at the back. He grew all his own vegetables with this 44-gallon drum. And Mum used to buy vegetables there, and his wife, he used to talk to Mum about his wife in China. He used to send money to her. And he used to always say to her, "When are you coming home to China with me to meet my wife?" And Mum would say, oh, you know, I'll think about it. And he was always, Mum used to tell us this all the time, oh, Billy Quinton's asked me to go to China again. Anyway, one day she came home, she'd given, it must have been Christmas, she gave him, he gave her this lovely big cake. And she said she was a bit dubious about eating it, but she said when she cut it, it was the best cake she'd ever tasted, because apparently he had been a cook in a hotel somewhere. So
it sounds like the relationship between you guys, at least, and the Chinese was pretty good.
Oh, well, it was, yeah. And of course, everything was cheap. You know, like Mum had sent us to the butcher with a note, probably a shilling or 2 shillings, and you could buy a whole lot of meat.
Mm.
And the other thing I remember, the Paramount Theatre was just, it's not there now, but just past this Billy Quinton shop, the big Paramount Theatre was between Wallace Street and Tantyther Street. There's car sales yards there now, yeah, where there's a lot of car sales. And there's Paramount Theatre. In those days, like if you go to the movies today, you only see one main movie, and you might see a trailer or advertisements or something. But in those days, for sixpence, you'd have 2 movies. It'd be an A-grade movie and a B-grade movie. But you'd see the movie town news, and there'd be a cartoon, and there'd be a trailer for what was going to happen next, you know, next Saturday.
Can I ask you when your dad left? How old were you?
I was only about, I was at high school, 12 or 13 or 14.
Right, and did he...
I don't want to talk about that, really.
Sure, no. Okay. Okay, I'll come back to the movie theatre. Yeah. Did you go to the movies very often?
Yeah, and what we used to do, this Paramount Theatre, they had canvas chairs, and there was all, it was a cement floor, and they used, on a Saturday afternoon, they used to push all the chairs away, and that was a skating rink also. And because it was cement, the skates used to make dust, you know, cement dust, and they'd go over all these canvas seats. And upstairs, that was where that was the dearest section. They were like downstairs, there was big sort of squatter seats, but upstairs they were something like this. And one of the blokes who worked there used to get wee kids to come along and clean these seats. And what you did, he'd cut a broomstick, you know, about that much broomstick, and sewed all this old material, you know, heavy material. So you'd go along bashing all these seats. The dust would just go up in the air like that, come back again. And we used to get letters and pictures for nothing. You know, instead of paying sixpence, we'd go home with dust up our nose and in our eyes and ears, and probably 2 hours working and bashing these bloody seats. And the dust was always there.
Did you go to the movies an interesting event?
Oh, they were good. There's what we liked best was the cereal. They used to be like Tarzan and Tom Mix and all those cowboy things, and the seal always finished up at the end. The hero was coming towards a waterfall or something, and he was going to go over the waterfall, so, you know, he's going to get killed for sure. So all the week at school we'd be saying, oh, I wonder how he gets out of this. And so he'd go again next Saturday, and what had happened, he'd just get near the waterfall and grab a tree here, you know, or there'd be something like on a train line, the train would be rushing towards him, and he was going to get killed for sure. But when you saw the next week's trailer, somebody pulled him off the line or something. So that was always exciting to talk about at school.
And did the whole town turn up?
Oh, they were always pretty crowded. It was yummy. Oh, there was another theatre further up, opposite Bus Park, you know, where the Moncrief Theatre is now. Mm. That was called the Olympia Theatre, and it was open air. Or the back part was covered. That's where the socialites sat. When we ordinary people sat out, there was big brick walls on both sides, but you're out in the open. If it rained, you just got wet. You try to come up and stand amongst all these people, it was pretty hard to fit in under there.
Do you think Bundaberg was a two-tiered sort of society with people who had money?
There certainly was the snob area, and those snobbies, my mother used to talk about it. The, like most of the people involved with the sugarcane mills, Tim, there was the Buss and Turners and the Redden and Mellers and Crans, and the Youngs out at Ferrymead. That lasted quite a few years, but I think it went, like after the war, that sort of disappeared and everybody's sort of equal now. But in those days, like these people, my mother even had a job working for one of these people worked in their home doing their work for them. She said they were nice people. They used to give her presents at Christmas and so on, but she would have been just a servant. Like a lot of those houses had, they would have had a gardener, I suppose, and a servant to cook the meals and do the washing and ironing. I mean, those sort of days are gone now. Not too many people have someone to do the washing and ironing.
And I guess it was pretty tough for your mum too, looking after
your
boys.
Yeah, on her own, yeah. See, my mother was an angel for... She put us all through high school. We were never hungry. She made her own clothes. She had worked... In the earlier days, she worked in a tailoress shop. So she even made our clothes, you know, our little pants and coats and shirts. So I didn't find out till later on from relatives and so on just what sacrifices she made for us.
Now, if you were born in 1926, you'd have been 10 years old when the distillery did the second fire.
Yeah, what happened about that, we were down in Waller Street. There was this tremendous storm that night, lightning and thunder and rain, and all of a sudden there's all these booming noises going off, you know, about a couple of miles down that way. And we all went out in the footpath to see what was going on, and you could see in the sky the kegs of rum, and they used to make methylated spirits and other spirits in those days. They were all exploding, shooting up in the air, and, you know, really colourful. Must have been hundreds of them, one after the other. And then it eventually died down, but the next day my mother drove us down the river. And every Tom, Dick and Harry was down there. And people, everyone had a boat, because what happened when the rum distillery, when it set on fire, all the rum and everything ran into the river. And the river was on fire, the top of the river, and it also would have used the oxygen, you know, fish need oxygen. So besides the fire and the oxygen, the fish were all gasping for breath. Little fish right up to big grapers. There's photos down there now at the rum distillery where men were just in a little boat, you know, smaller than this table, trying to haul a big graper in.
A graper, so that's a sea fish.
Oh, grape, well, it is, but they lived in the river too. Mm. They're monstrous things. You know, their body's like this, about 5 foot, 6 foot long.
So the big sort of...
They were big, they could just about...
100 pounds?
Oh, yeah, probably more than that. Yeah. And some of the fish, they'd haul them in, and they'd still be flapping around and they'd jump out again. So they'd try and, you know, grab that one. And I remember Mum, a couple of days later in the news, Mum, she read this story out to us. I don't know if it was true or not, but she reckoned somebody fed some of this fish to their cat and the cat slept for 4 days. That's, you know, might be a good newspaper story, but because the fish was impregnated with rum and spirits and so on, and, mm. I've told that story many times. I don't know if it's true or not.
And what was the river like around that time? I mean, prior to the fire and around that time generally? Because it'd be a very different place then than it was now.
We lived, I tell you, we spent a lot of time in the river. And just down from us on the river bank, there was this big sugar shed, monstrous galvanised iron high-storey building. And the sugar used to come, there was a rival line right in front of it. At that time, the sugar was in bags. It was brown sugar. It used to come from probably Ferrymead and Isis Mill. And these rail wagons would come along, stop outside this sugar shed where men were employed. And they used to drop the side of the wagon down, and the men used to have to carry these 70-pound bags on their shoulders. You know, they'd turn around and there'd be a bloke up in the truck throwing the bag on. And they'd go to this sugar shed, and the only mechanical thing they had in there was this big loader. It started from the floor, went right, it was like an endless chain, went right up to the top. So they'd start loading these bags, they'd start on the floor, like make a pattern, put one that way and this way and try to lock them in. And they'd eventually get to the height where they had to use this load. I don't know where it was, run by diesel, I suppose. And so it went right up the top, and the men had to be up the top. And as the bag came off, they had to stand, you know, with their back to it, and the bag had come off, put it on there and go and load it, stack it up. And what used to happen, if they didn't stack them properly, eventually the thing had collapsed. Some of the men didn't have to jump for their life. They'd have to sort of start again, because the stack had started to get, instead of being level, you know, started to get like this. So that meant the sugar shed was full of these bags of sugar. And then these coastal ships used to come up. The sugar shed had, oh, I forget what it was at the back down on the river. I don't know how they transported the sugar to the ships. But this brown sugar went into these coast. They weren't big, but they were fairly big. They were river ships. And those ships would have come to Brisbane, and I don't think they're big enough to go overseas. And then further up the river, or next to that, was the what they call the coal chutes, because these boats had to be fired by coal. So wagons came along again full of coal, and they had trolleys. They used to shovel the coal out of the rail wagon into these trolleys, take them along to this, was a big steel chute, you know, aimed down like that. This was opened, and they'd tip all this coal into the chute, and the ship would be down there on the water. And they must have, I don't know how they did it, had to be over the hole where they kept the coal. So all the coal had come out of the chute down into the ship.
So the river was navigable back then?
Yeah, it would have been.
When did it silt up?
Oh, I think when they started to build the dams further up. They built the Ben Anderson Barrage, and
that's when you noticed that the ships couldn't get up anymore.
Well, those sort of ships, they weren't very big ships, but I think when they built this barrage, it sort of stopped. It also affected the fish life, because fish need salt water. They also need fresh water, and the fresh water used to come down from the back of the river. And the fish, you know, they'd spawn in that. Even out to sea, there was always a patch of fresh water. And because they started building these barrages to make dams, you know, for the sugar cane, it cut the trickle down. And there was a lot of professional fishermen who used to use the river. They used to have those big throw nets, you know, the big nets, and catching prawns and fish. Well, all that sort of went by the wayside, because fish, they were still there, but not in the same proportion.
And was it clear, the river, back then?
Oh, yeah, we used to swim in it.
And it was, you could open your eyes under the water?
Yeah. We used to fish in it. Mostly you'd catch catfish. You know what catfish are?
Yep.
They got that damn spike.
Yep.
We'd be in bare feet. You had to be careful you didn't walk on them. But we used to catch trumpeter and perch, and even you'd catch a baby shark. And if there was a shark that big, there must have been a mother and father somewhere.
And was there much vegetation along the river?
Oh, there were the mangroves. The family was across the way. I remember during the war, a Catalina plane landed on the river. Remember the Catalinas?
No, this is a plane you're talking about.
Yeah, it was a plane. It was like a flying, it was a seaplane. The bottom was scooped. It had wheels. Mm. It could land on the land, but the bottom was shaped like the hell of a boat. And they were used up in New Guinea a lot. They were very slow, but they were American Catalina.
Austin Whitaker, it's been wonderful talking to you. I wish we could keep talking longer. You're just such a source of information here. And thank you so much.
My pleasure.